Okay, cool. I'll let Sarah get us started.
Hi, everyone. So yeah, my name is Sarah. I am the co-chair of Chicago DSA's Lift the Ban on Rent Control Committee. For a little bit of background around what that is, in the 90s, a conservative think tank wrote this policy to prohibit local municipalities from enacting rent control, and they did this in about 37 different states across the country. It's very clear that they do this so that they can hold on to their profits and so that they can continue to commodify housing. And I think it's really important that we use this fight to raise class consciousness and realize that the real estate developers are our class enemies, and that they're profiting off of every single one of us. And just to kind of talk about what that's looked like in a couple different ways, we've had a couple different components happening at the same time in this campaign. One of them was around aldermanic elections here in Chicago. So we recently elected six socialists to city council. It's great. And one of the running themes across all of the campaigns, regardless of where in the city they were, was around housing justice and naming the real estate developers as the class enemy in each of these. And the real estate industry knew this. When you look at who was funding every single one of our opponents, it was the real estate industry. There were elections where it wasn't necessarily a socialist was running, but a pretty left progressive was running against the housing chair of Chicago City Council. And she ran on a lot of housing justice related issues, and she won her election because this chair was just abusing the system, or using the system exactly as it was intended. And so one of the ways that we did that was through heavy research to begin. So we spent a lot of time going through and figuring out who the major players were, both politically and in the real estate industry, and looking at who was evicting people at the highest rates, what companies, and looking at where they were spending their money in politics. And then using that to target escalation campaigns against them. So we had two things. So one was very locally, there was a developer landlord by the name of Mark Fishman here in Chicago, who was very upset that he no longer had a blank check when there was one socialist in city council, Carlos Rosa, and Carlos would not allow him to do whatever he wanted in the ward anymore. He was very upset by this, so he handpicked somebody to run against Carlos and funded the majority of her campaign. And we used that. I mean, we talked to people on the doors about how Mark Fishman was funding her, pushing her. People knew that he was the person who was evicting everyone de facto by raising the rents by like $1,000 a month when he bought new buildings. So people got it. At a larger level, there was a company, or there is a company, called Pangea. And we recognized that they were the largest company doing the most evictions in Cook County. So we ran a direct action against Pangea and against their CEO in a series of direct actions that we were doing on the first of every month. First of the month, rent is due, rent control is past due. And when we first ran this direct action against Pangea's CEO, people didn't really know who they were. And so it was interesting because a couple months later, the Chicago Reader ran this very extensive expose on what Pangea was doing and how they were being really predatory, especially in South Shore, on black working class communities, and pushing gentrification. So I wanna talk about how this disinvestment versus gentrification question is playing out a little bit. Because we've seen throughout our aldermanic elections how this differs. So like Carlos's ward, the 35th ward in Chicago, has a very high rate of gentrification happening by a lot of investment by developers to raise rents, kick out working class communities, whereas the disinvestment is happening in neighborhoods around the Obama Presidential Center, where it's going to be. And this was in the 20th ward where Jeanette Taylor was running. And it was playing out by large real estate companies buying up all of this land around where the Obama Presidential Center is going and not investing in it yet, not building anything on it yet, just holding it. And so these communities are starved for resources, and the developers are just waiting for everyone to be pushed out by the Obama Presidential Center, and then they'll make nice things for all the rich people who move in. So I wanted to touch on that because I think that that's really important in looking at what unites us as a working class movement across different communities, where people might see these as two competing things, and they're really very connected because the real estate industry is really pushing for their ability to preserve their profits. So something else I wanted to touch on was kind of our coalition strategy, because we as socialists cannot alone do this work. We have to work with other groups, and that can be really hard sometimes. So when we were first talking about what implementation of rent control would look like, there were groups in our coalition who were like, oh, well, we have to like compromise and allow like means testing to happen. Because that's what the legislators are pushing. And it's really important that we as socialists are in those rooms where those decisions are being made, because we were able to push back on that and say that no, you cannot means test this. It has to be a universal demand. It has to unite the working class and be something that everyone can fight behind. And part of this coalition building, so our coalition is made up of Chicago DSA. There are around like 40 something groups now in the coalition. There are a lot of community organizations that are hyper local. There's also some citywide organizations and unions. And the union influx has been really powerful for us recently. It's a kind of new uptick. So SEIU was involved, and a DSA member who works for HUD was able to get her union of the American Federation of Government Employees to endorse the campaign as like HUD workers. And then most recently, CTU has come on as a full partner in the coalition, and they are preparing for their contract expired, and they are preparing for possibly going on strike. And they are including housing demands in their contract and relating how schools operate in terms of neighborhood schools and how people access education with where people are able to live, both the families of their students and whether or not they're homeless, and how that affects their ability to learn in the classroom, and also the teachers and how they're able to be connected to their communities. Like Chicago, as a lot of other places, have a rule that if you work for Chicago Public Schools, you have to live in the city of Chicago. If people are getting priced out because they can't afford housing because it's rising exponentially and their wages aren't going up at the same rate, how are they supposed to do that? I feel like we tried to make this very clear in the aldermanic elections. Part of what we talked about throughout all the campaigns is we had three overarching Chicago for All demands. One was housing for all, and the other two were education for all and sanctuary for all. And those were very interconnected. And it made sense for us to talk about this demand for housing for every single person, because it's something that affects every working class person. There, like, if you don't have kids, maybe you don't think about education for all, or there are just like different sections where the working class isn't as united, but every single person needs housing. So it's something that we as socialists should be pushing and fighting for, because it's a way to unite the entire class. And it's real, I wanna go back to what I was saying earlier about research, because when we're looking to get involved in these fights, we need to know exactly what we're up against and how we're going to actually affect change. And if we decide to just like jump into something because theoretically it makes sense, but we don't know the real, like, realistic grounds of what's happening around us, then we're not going to be able to do anything. So I would really encourage anyone who's trying to get involved in housing work to see what other groups are working around housing in your area, what they are working on, who the major players are, and to really make sure that you have backed up research on everything that's happening before you jump in, because otherwise you're going to end up just like paddling upstream. And not to be like, we did a great job of this, but like we spent a lot of time doing research before we got super involved. It was brought up at the electoral panel earlier, but we made a website called Who Bought Your Neighborhood during the aldermanic elections. And we spent a lot of time researching who the developers were in every single ward that we were fighting in, and how much money in dollar amounts they spent on our opponents. And over the course of our opponents' terms as aldermen, what those developers were able to get done that benefited them and hurt the working class. We amplified that and really identified by name every single developer and every single politician that was in their pockets, and just making sure that that's super heightened and that everyone in your neighborhoods understands that that is the class enemy.
Hello, again, my name is Ryan. I'm one of the co-chairs of the Iowa City DSA, and it looks like this room needed to be rezoned for higher density. How's everybody feeling? Good? All right. So us in Iowa, we're really excited about the work getting done across the country in the bigger cities around rent control and around winning electoral races at the city council level and building that sort of grassroots power. Unfortunately for us in Iowa, we have a legislature and a governor that is all Republican. And there are concerted efforts by Republicans to be pro-landlord, to be pro-developer, and even among the Democratic Party, that's not going to twist it or anything. So our struggle in Iowa City and Johnson County, where we reside, is that we live in the most expensive county in the state. There are 58% of renters who are cost burdened or who are paying 30% or more of their housing or of their income on housing. And that's gonna only grow to about 2/3 of renters by 2020. So what we're facing is an increasingly a higher supply of housing, but not a better affordability of it. So, and this is often a talking point for the pro-developer Democrats or so-called progressives who say, if we build the supply, the price will come down. Well, where is the price coming down? Because it's certainly not happening in our community, and I guarantee that it's not happening elsewhere. So, a little bit of like background about what our fight has been including is that there have been out-of-state investment firms and developers that have eaten up mobile home communities in Iowa who have bought the land and have raised rents anywhere from 40 to 50% on their residents who live on a lease that is month to month. So as soon as the next month, these rents could be increased just like that. We are facing also, there is like the biggest housing development, the 15-story development in Iowa City is taking place, and it had to be rezoned by city council with very few stipulations, but it is going to be owned by the biggest slumlord in Iowa City, who owns a company called Apartments Downtown, which this is, and kind of going off of the, what was that company that knew?
Pangea.
Yeah, it's kind of like a Pangea theme going on here, because Apartments Downtown had lost a lawsuit, and their name or their brand was tarnished, so they subdivided this huge corporation into many different LLCs, so they're many heads of one hydra. So, you know, how do you cut off those heads and ultimately get to the source of the issue? And we do have some groups, we did some research in our community where we identified who the key players were and who were advocating for renters and for those in housing insecure situations. And we found that it was mainly homeowners and well-to-do white liberals who wanted to tack on an inclusionary zoning policy or increase an affordable housing fund, but really it's short of what needs to really happen, which is, I think in many of our views, is a truly a housing justice-centered public housing initiative where instead of having the mobile homes be eaten up by out-of-state private companies, that these mobile home neighborhoods could be municipally owned or publicly owned, cooperatively owned, so that there is a line of defense against outside investment to eat up this real estate and then displace further folks in our community. And so where does DSA come in? So we, having identified, you know, who those key players were, that we do have allies on council. One of our strongest comrade who's on the council right now is just determined that he's not going to run for re-election. So it's difficult because I had run for city council in Iowa City a few years back and came up against this sort of like faux progressive, I'm still taking money from developers, but in Iowa we passed gay marriage, but she's like, oh, I'm pro LGBTQ. But it's like a thing of the past. But there's often these folks, and I'm sure it happened in Chicago too, is like they're in the pockets of the developers, but they have an appearance of progressivism or liberalism and gets them to these positions of power, where then once they're there, they stab the renters and the people who are oppressed in the back. So we're losing that comrade, and I think having our eyes towards electoral politics is really important. It's also a point to be sure that you're not diverting enough energy into an electoral campaign, because what we found is like even if you get those people in office, those barriers to pass like public housing or a municipally owned neighborhood are so difficult that you need that grassroots support, that need the renters and people at the very who are most oppressed by housing to have an upswelling of power and then go from there. So that is why we identified housing as the number one issue. We were using tools from the Midwest Academy to have a strategy surrounding housing, and that the eventual goal is that, yes, housing for all, housing justice, like, and you know, filtered into also like ending capitalism and all this jazz. But in the interim, there needs to be like incremental steps towards that path to victory. And part of that path has been canvassing for the creation of an Iowa City Tenants Union, which is not unique in Iowa either. There are many other organizations in our region who are taking this approach. And as socialists, as lefties, as however we identify, this is where the base can be and should be, I believe, because housing is that such a priority in many of our lives. So that there is an Ames Tenants Union, where our sister university, the big like Division I university, is Dubuque Renters Union, Omaha Tenants United in Nebraska, and so we're seeing this groundswell of tenants unions coming about. But I think that focus needs to still be there, and we are attempting to build statewide solidarity as well in Iowa so that when it comes to passing like rent control or any policy, which is impossible right now, we have the momentum, the people, and the power to shift the policies at the state level and not just where we're doing things locally. Because in Iowa City, we've passed a minimum wage hike in the county, but then the state preempted us and said, well, you can't do that, because I guess sometimes Republicans like home rule, sometimes they don't. It just depends on like what their friends in the business world have to say about it. So we've been preempted on wage laws, on how many people you could have in a housing dwelling, and so it's very blatantly a corruption of power at the state level. So what is required of us then is to be in our communities very intentional that what we're doing is not just building electoral power, but building renter power to that can build, not just in our local counties and communities, that we can build a statewide policy that gets us to victory. And it may not be until 2022 when we can get the legislature in a place where it needs to be and get our governor out of office. But until then, it takes organizations like DSA to really have a focus and have their minds set towards this sort of vision with incremental steps towards victory too. So that's why we had helped create the Iowa City Tenants Union, which is now in full formation. Our board has just been elected and now their bylaws are in place. So we're excited and now it's a really prime opportunity because the turn of the lease period in our university town. We're home to the University of Iowa, forgot to mention. The turn of the lease period is at the end of this month. And we're going to take photos and encourage renters to document everything because there is mold, maintenance ignored, there is tainted water in a lot of our neighborhoods. And so documenting that and giving renters the tools to then take on their landlords through collective and direct action, instead of taking it to the courts, is where we're going to win. Because renters and the oppressed, the courts are not our turf. They're not where we're going to see the utmost, the most powerful victories. But we can take to the streets, take to their offices, take to the developer's office, to the landlord's office, and say, you are in direct violation of the state code regarding under tenant law. And then we have seen movement from that approach. So I'm really looking forward to hearing from other folks about what housing work is getting done in their communities and nationwide. And I think that building this sort of, not just the statewide solidarity I was speaking about in Iowa, but building our solidarity throughout this country is really important. And particularly for us in Iowa, because for some bizarre reason, Iowa is still the first caucus and primary in the nation. So we have presidential hopefuls coming through there every other day. And so we have this strange opportunity at a platform. And so I'm thinking through this right now, if we want housing to be on the national agenda for the presidential hopefuls, come to Iowa, or go to New Hampshire, or South Carolina, like the key primary states, and then make noise. And I think that there is a great opportunity to capitalize on this really bizarre electoral cycle, because once you have the ears of the most powerful politicians, we can have Housing for All be on the national debate stage. And it was nowhere to be found at the last debate, and it will not happen at the next one. But if we are able to build that momentum and build that power and have Housing for All on the agenda, then I think that we'll be able to see some victories and go from there.
Testing. Sorry, my vocal fry. I first wanted to make sure that we spoke about the grossest housing injustice that's happening in this country right now. It's at our southern border in the concentration camps. In 2014 and 2015, when Germany was faced with migrants and refugees from Syria, they put them into housing. There's countless conspiracy theories about how housing was seized. We have 16 million vacant homes in the nation And we're suddenly worried that there's 160,000 people at our southern border? You've got to be kidding. So I got involved in housing organizing by buying a home in a community I did not research. I was a white liberal. I know how to speak their language. But when the elder next door moved out, it started to dawn on me that we don't have at-home care. That's a tenants' rights issue. When my next neighbor moved out because they were robbed at gunpoint, lost the ability to do their job due to trauma, that showed that victims' rights are housing rights too. That person had to move out. They don't show up on the eviction data. When the person across the street from me had to move out because their Section 8, that is subsidized housing landlord, was terrorizing them, and then they were later dropped from Section 8 housing due to that landlord, that's a tenants' rights issue. I had to work for months with that person to get them back into the tenant union's office, to get them reinstated on Section 8 housing. They are now housed in the unincorporated territory of Urbana, and they have their own car, and they're now self-sufficient, but their lives were going to be devastated, and they were going to be chronically insecure housing. They were, at that time, they were staying in a mixed family house with their aunt. Their family members were calling their children the N-word. She was traumatized by this. She would not have survived on this. Housing is a life or death issue. I'm currently hosting a millennial who was abused by their parents at the age of 29, who had called me up when I was in Wisconsin for a conference, said that I had a suicidal crisis 2 days ago. Housing is a life or death issue. So, I'm from Champaign County. I'm here to talk about my community. Champaign County has 208,000 people. We have 9,000 vacant housing units. We have zero year-round emergency homeless shelters. We are governed by two city councils that are led by landlords that have landlords in the representation. We have landlords in our county board, and they just privatized our public nursing home that had been run for over a century. When I got involved, I started with talking to the Champaign City Council Board. How do they not have a year-round homeless shelter? Surely they'd let the libraries burn down before that happened. They knew about it. They invited me to go to a continuum of care meeting where a bunch of nonprofits say, we have the issue solved. Just send people to our seasonal shelters. Everything will be fine. I have a bad day when my kitchen is dirty. How is someone supposed to build a solid foundation for their life when they don't know where they're going to sleep or in what conditions they're going to sleep? After a Champaign City Council meeting, I ran into some homeless individuals who were sleeping under a railroad bridge. They stuffed their blankets in the I-beams. They were terrorized by a garden snake that took up refuge next to them. They were about to have a crisis. One of the guys was saying, I must not kill animals, I will not kill animals. He was going manic. I called I called the animal control, would not respond, too late in the evening. I called private animal control, would not respond, non-venomous snake. This was following a city council meeting where landlords were griping about losing their power and being inconvenienced by decreasing the number of years they could discriminate against people with felony records when it comes to access to housing. One of the people staying under that bridge is a felon. While they were worried about losing their power, these folks were sleeping with snakes. I had to take a stick and get the snake out of there. That is absurd. That is wrong. In our particular area, Champaign, the city, 59% rent burdened, paying over 30% of their income due for housing. That means they're at an increased risk of eviction. It's an insurance measure above anything else. In Urbana, it is 66%. We're already at 2/3 rent burdened. When we confronted the Urbana City Council about their rent burden, as well as the fact that they have a higher childhood poverty rate than other Midwest towns of a similar size that are also college towns, they said Urbana doesn't feel poor. In terms of the amount of control that landlords have in our community, we are admittedly a college town. 55% of Champaign and 61% of Urbana's occupied housing is renter occupied. They own both of these cities. Despite that, when we joined the Fair Housing Campaign's initiative to start door knocking to repeal that discriminatory housing ordinance, we lost, but we decreased it from 5 years of discrimination to 2 years of discrimination. That is a 25-year-old ordinance in the city of Champaign. The National Low Income Housing Coalition estimates that the living wage is no longer $15 an hour in 44 out of 50 states in this country. It is double, more than double, the minimum wage in Illinois for the cost of living in either Urbana or Champaign. So when people lose their Section 8 because more than one income earner are staying in the same household, when people are subjected to inhospitable living conditions because they have to double up potentially with their domestic abuser to afford their housing, and then someone gripes about losing their power, we have to call them out. This information is something that anybody can look for on the American Fact Finder that is run by the Census Bureau. They don't just do the census every 10 years. They do annual American Community Survey estimates and American Housing Survey estimates. Just with that resource and a spreadsheet where I just wrote in the stats, in collaboration with the Cunningham Township Supervisor's Office, we approached the Housing Authority of Champaign County, and they then committed right then and there to build 24 affordable housing units in the city of Champaign, Urbana. That's with a spreadsheet and about a half an hour's worth of time. This is something anybody in this room can do. Since then, I've started to do a little more advanced analysis. I won't bore you with those details, but what I will say is that in no place is disability income sufficient to live. In no place is the minimum income sufficient to live. We have to use the fact that states can increase both of those things to fix one of the most fundamental and dire housing needs issues that people have. This is also a single parent's issue. If you're a single parent, you might be forced to partner up just to make ends meet with another single parent because you'll feel safer there. That is going to be a burdensome. Just because we have state-subsidized childcare in the state of Illinois does not mean that's good enough. People take minimum wage jobs because they can't have access to the higher paid entry level hourly work that starts before that subsidized childcare. So when people are asking me, why are you occupying someone's office? Why are you running a weekly canvas? It's because people are dying. It's because people are being abused. It has to stop.
Hey everyone, so my name is Brian Sullivan. I'm a member, as I said earlier, of the Central Brooklyn branch of DSA. And I want to talk a little bit about the US legal system, and specifically in the context of a massive win we've had in New York around rent control. That's supposed to be called rent control. I wanted an applause on that. There's been a major sort of overhaul of rent control or rent stabilization laws in New York State. This was an enormous win. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some, I think, thorny questions we have to think through with respect to a win like this. Sort of focused on like the lawness of it. I hope that doesn't sound too boring, but the law has this dual character where there are absolutely wonderful things about a very strong set of rights that you get with rent stabilization. It can protect you from being evicted. It protects you from having your rent raised unreasonably. And at the same time, as socialists, I think we can recognize there are sharp limitations to what we can ever win within the US legal system. As Ryan had said, the courts are sort of unfriendly territory for working class movements in many ways. So I want to talk through that a little bit in the specific context of rent control. In my professional life, the way I get involved with the tenants movement is as a tenants attorney. So there'll maybe be a tenants association that's formed. I'll come in to help out with maybe bringing a landlord to court for repairs or defending it against an eviction, that sort of thing. And all these different contradictions are sort of played out in there. And so I guess in the context of rent control, I want to start with a few of the good things that we see with a victory like this. First off, it's worth saying it's sort of impossible to imagine the US housing movement now outside of these battles for rent control. This has been something that has just really caught fire in the United States. It's really inspiring to people. It is something that's motivating. Like in the elections meeting right before this, we heard a lot about how rent control is tied to what motivates people to get out and get more political. We just heard movingly about some of the benefits that can provide. This is a hugely important aspect of the current housing justice movement. On top of that, take the win in New York State. To win those reforms in rent control, the tenants movement, the working class movement, had to go directly in the face of one of, if not the most powerful industry in New York State, and a very well-organized industry. Real estate has these, New York, there's this organization called Remedy, and they're a hiss-worthy organization. They're awful. They organize landlords, they do everything in their power to exert political control in the state, and they're really, really good at it. They're well-funded, their clients and members are integral to the functioning of New York State's economy. Real estate is just central to New York's economy being buoyed, and that gives them an enormous amount of power. To win rent control, the tenants movement had to get right in their face and had to beat them at their own game, and it did. That's incredible. That is not. Yeah, that is worthy of that. That's remarkable. It's something that hasn't happened in New York in a generation, in literally decades. And that raises expectations. It makes us understand that while this industry is powerful, we can beat it. We can beat it in New York. I understand real estate is incredibly powerful here in Chicago. We can beat it in Chicago. We can beat it in Iowa. We can win these fights, and we saw that in New York. So this, winning rent control in that respect it teaches us lessons about what, and gives us confidence in what we can accomplish, what the working class can accomplish. There's also this sort of harm reduction element that I sort of touched on earlier. If you live in a state that has, or a city that has rent control, you're less likely to be evicted. All the worst eviction crises throughout the United States are in states where there's this preemption that Illinois has, where cities cannot pass laws that would protect their tenants. And some smaller cities that you don't think of as renter cities, like smaller cities in Virginia, see these massive numbers of evictions. And it is absolutely devastating. Evictions target, in a sort of uniquely vile way, women of color. They're way more likely to be evicted than anyone else. It drives people into poverty. It isn't just a result of poverty, but actually causes poverty. And rent control protects against some of that. There's this question that was raised at the beginning about how the demands we're making now build the power of the working class. If you know that you're secure in your housing, there's a lot of stuff you can do that you can't do otherwise. If you know that you can't be evicted because, let's say you went on strike, or you're thinking about going on strike, and you know you're gonna miss a month or two of rent, and if you have some assurance that you're not gonna be evicted because of that, that you're gonna have this whole set of protections, that makes that possible in a way that it might not have been otherwise. If your apartment is in bad shape and you just want to get in your landlord's face about it, you're way more likely to do that if you're not going to be just evicted the very next month because of that. So there's any number of ways that this is immensely important. These are immensely important wins for the working class. Now I'm going to say a couple negative things about rent control, which should in no way, I don't see in any way to undermine the positive things I just said. We have to hold these two things in our head at the same time. But the sort of negative things I want to say about it is rent control does not in and of itself somehow destroy the private market for housing. It regulates that market, the market becomes much better for tenants, but it remains. Housing remains something you have to buy on the market. And you see cities and states with rent control, like New York City has rent control. It's not like housing's affordable there because of that. We've had rent control for a very, very long time, and it remains a wildly unaffordable city. And the basic structure of landlords being able to profit off a housing market and gaining all this sort of structural political power within the political process, within our economy, the larger political system, rent control shifts the balance on that somewhat, but it leaves that intact. And I think there's some slightly more abstract things we could say about it too. I'd say law has this dual nature, and one aspect of that is like individualized, sort of atomized rights are a huge part of what law is. That I have a right, sort of as an individual, as a renter. It's that's woven into like what it is to have a right at a very profound level. Not to say that necessarily undermines or there's no way to have solidarity in combination with that, but it does have this individualizing character that I think we just need to be sort of be wary of and have our heads around. So you have these like good and bad elements. We should be having these fights. I mean, I think we've heard some great stuff about different fights for rent control, the benefits it can have. And I think where I want to end is on what our role as socialists, our role as members of DSA, and non-DSA members as well, is in sort of thinking through these problems and in strategizing around this. And I guess the key thing I want to take away there is it's our job to imagine a society and fight for a society where you don't have to go to a marketplace. You don't have a landlord who you have to rent from. We like rent at the end of the day, rent is theft from working class people. And it is, you know, again, as we heard a second ago, it's sort of sickening the way that the US housing market has utterly failed to do its basic task, which is provide housing for people. It doesn't do that. You know, I think the latest study of national homeless figures is something like 500,000 in the United States. In New York City alone, there's 60,000 homeless people every night, almost half of whom are children. The market for housing has failed, and it will continue to fail. It will always fail. Our task is to imagine and to start organizing for a world in which we don't have to rely on that market. So I think you see that in very concrete ways. I'm trying to look at the example. Oh, Sarah gave the thing of means testing. We can push in these sort of like smaller battles. We push, we say no, means testing is wrong. And then we constantly push for that bigger, better version of what our lives could be. And that is the task that we have for ourselves right now. And very, very excited to talk about that with one and also win that.